Hey there, this is Brian Zond, and welcome to my sermon podcast. I'm glad that you're interested in the sermons that I preach here at Word of Life Church in St. Joseph, Missouri. And if you ever feel inclined to help us by supporting us financially, you can do that at our website, WOLC.com. Thank you. The truth can change a man in the wisdom of his days. It whispers soft but constantly, "You cannot live this way." I first heard that song by the band The Call, the most underrated rock band in history, by the way. I first heard that song 30 years ago. And those lyrics, that song, to this day I have it all memorized. It has stuck with me for 30 years. But especially those opening lines. The truth can change a man in the wisdom of his days. It whispers soft but constantly, "You cannot live this way." The song is speaking to the madness of modernity. You know what I mean by that? The madness of modern life. The pace, the stress, the noise. I know we've advanced in technology, and I embrace it all. Right here. We've advanced in technology, but have we regressed in wisdom and how to care for our soul? Got a thought experiment for you. I use this thought experiment in prayer school. Some of you have heard it before. But as with all of my thought experiments, it involves a time machine. You got a time machine? Can you imagine you do? Maybe a TARDIS, maybe a DeLorean, maybe a phone booth, whatever works for you. And here's what we do. We get in our time machine, and we just crank the dial back 1,000 years. So we're going to go from 2018 to 1018. And we're going to just set it right there. We're just going to aim for the middle of France, sort of the center of emerging Western culture. And so we take our time machine and we arrive in the year 1018 in some field in France, medieval France. And what we're going to do next is kind of mean. What we're going to do is we're going to kidnap the first peasant we find. So we set out and we find some farmer in his field, poor hapless soul. We grab him, throw him in our time machine, and we bring him back here. And what we're going to do with this medieval peasant is he is going to live his life with us for 1 week. He's going to live our life in late modernity. He's going to see what we see, do what we do, live like we live, go where we go. He's going to do our life with us for 1 week. And at the end of the week, we put him back in the time machine, take him back to where we found him and let him go. Now, here's where the thought experiment begins. This guy has a tale to tell, doesn't he? And when he sits with his friends in the tavern, what does he say? How does he tell the story? How does he relate what has happened to him? I think he would say something like this. "Last week I was kidnapped by demons. And I was taken to hell. And I lived in hell for a week. And in hell, they just go, go, go. They don't rest. They don't sleep enough. It never really gets dark enough to sleep. It's never quiet. They just go all the time. I went to hell for a week." He'll probably write a book. It'll be a bestseller, except they don't have the printing press yet. But you know what I'm saying. I think there's something to that. Now, mind you, I am not a Luddite. You know what a Luddite? Someone that just is opposed to all technology. No, I'm not that way at all. I mean, when I need to go to the dentist, I want to go to a 21st century dentist, mind you. I'm not interested in an 11th century dentist. I'm fine with embracing technology. I do. It's in my life. But isn't there a sense that we're losing something? That along with all of our tremendous advancement in science and technology, that somewhere we've lost our way. And the truth can change a man in the wisdom of his days. It whispers soft but constantly, you cannot live this way. So I want to preach a series of sermons on Sunday mornings on tending to your soul in a soulless age. Now I'm calling the series and the first sermon in the series, A Life That We Can Live. Which also comes from a song. It's from the song Wasted Hours by the brilliant Arcade Fire on their album The Suburbs from 2010, which won, deservedly so, Grammy Album of the Year. This is starting to sound like Finding God on your iPod, but that's all right. You pay attention to wisdom where you find it. And I really do. I think The Suburbs by Arcade Fire is both it's the best and the most important album of the 21st century. I think it really speaks. I mean, listen to it 100 times and you'll see what I mean. It starts unfolding. Every song on there seems to be brilliant. But here's the lyrics to Wasted Hours. It's where I got the title for this series. All those wasted hours we used to know. Spent the summer staring out the window. The wind, it takes you where it wants to go. First they build the road, then they build the town. That's why we're still driving around and around. And all we see are kids in buses longing to be free. Some cities make you lose your head. Endless suburbs stretched out thin and dead. What was that line you said? Wishing you were anywhere but here. You watched the life you're living disappear. And now I see we're still kids in buses longing to be free. Wasted hours before we knew where to go and what to do. Wasted hours that you make new and turn into a life that we can live. A life that we can live. Wasted hours. Long walks in the woods. A 3-hour lunch with a friend. Contemplative prayer. In the time is money madness of modernity, these are wasted hours. But they're the wasted hours that make you new and turn into a life that we can live. All right, we've heard from the call, we've heard from Arcade Fire. Let's hear some scripture. Exodus chapter 2, verse 25. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Well, what did God know? Well, this comes in Exodus, the end of chapter 2. And God saw Israel in their bondage. He saw Israel enslaved. He saw them enslaved to a life that they could not live. The Hebrews had come to Egypt as immigrants. And over time, they became slaves. They became the forced labor, the cheap labor for Pharaoh and his Egyptian empire. They were the ones that were baking the bricks because Pharaoh's got to have a bunch of bricks. And he'll never have enough bricks. And he's got to have more and more and more and more because he has to build and build and build and build. That's the only thing he knows to do. And he needs slave labor to do it. So he finds the Hebrews and he puts them in bondage. And God saw Israel and God knew that that was not a life they could live. Pharaoh was the richest man in the world. Without rival. Okay, at this time, I mean, he is the richest man in the world. He has everything times 10. And he's haunted by dreams of scarcity. Think about this. This guy's the richest man in the world by far. The wealthiest, mightiest empire in the world at the time is Egypt, and he has it. It's his. He rules with unrivaled sovereignty. He has everything. And he can't sleep at night. Because he's haunted by nightmares of there's not going to be enough. There's not going to be enough. I'm going to have all of this. I have all of this, but how do I know it's enough? Will there ever be enough? There can't ever be enough. And he can't sleep at night. Because he is haunted by dreams of scarcity. And so the philosophy of Pharaohs then and now is more, 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 more. You've got to have more, got to do more, got to make more, got to have more. And if we're enslaved by that system, we're stuck in a life that we can't live. Oh, we can exist. We can compete in the rat race. But that's not living. That's not flourishing. That's not the goodness of life. Jesus said, I've come that they might have life and have it abundantly so that it flourishes. But if you're enslaved by a pharaonic system of there's never enough. How do you know you have enough? You've got to have more, 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 faster, faster, faster. Keep going, more. No, you need more. Then God sees that. And God knows that you are enslaved in a life that you cannot live. And so God acts. And God raises up a deliverer for them. His name is Moses. Here's that part of the story, Exodus chapter 3, verse 1. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. And he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. At midlife, Moses ends up in the desert tending flocks for his father-in-law. That's a way of saying he's a failure. You know, he had been raised in the courts of Pharaoh. He was one of the great princes of Egypt. He was a big shot. He was important. He was successful. He was rich. He was living the life. But then things began to fall apart. We won't rehearse the story just now, but one thing led to another, and Moses at midlife finds himself at the foot of Mount Horeb, or that's Mount Sinai, out in the desert. It's a very mysterious place. I was there 11 years ago. I can tell you, The Sinai wilderness with Mount Horeb is an evocative place. Just to be there feels like prayer is being drawn out of you. You want to pray in a place like that. There's something about that place that invites you into mystery, invites you into prayer. And desert wildernesses have always been places for cultivating a deeper spirituality. It's why in the 4th century, when the church began to compromise and capitulate with the empire, that mystics and monks began to make their way into the desert to find a deeper spirituality. But what is it about deserts and sometimes also mountains that draw mystics and monks? I think that it has something to do with they are quiet and uncluttered places. Cities are loud, cluttered, frantic, distracting. And so there are times when people say, I got to get out of here. And they go into the wilderness places. I know for me, I cherish those times when I can be in the high tundra of the Colorado Rockies. I mean, way up above tree line, get up about 11, 12,000 feet. It's an open expanse. There's nothing cramped about it. It's the place where, as one poet said, the flowers are a millisecond and the sky is forever. I always do my best thinking about God in the high tundra, because you can't think small, petty thoughts up there. I think theologians who do all of their theology indoors are making a big mistake. Theologians need to be outdoorsmen. They need to get out of doors. They need to get out into the vast expanse of God's good creation. Well, here's middle-aged Moses in his failure, living a quiet life in a contemplative place. And I keep stressing that Moses was a failure. You know I don't really believe that, right? I'm taking the metrics of Egypt and the metrics of America and applying it to a middle-aged man who used to be a big somebody, a big shot, a big deal, and now he's hired help for his father-in-law. In the metrics of success and empire in America and Egypt, that's a failure. So, to use the language of Egypt, middle-aged Moses is a failure, but he's living a quiet life in a contemplative place, and suddenly Moses has a mystical experience, and it turns out to be one of the great turning points in the story of Scripture. In this wilderness, at the base of Mount Horeb, Moses comes across a bush that's on fire. Strange enough to begin with. Just out in the wilderness and no one's around. There's a bush that's on fire. But stranger yet, though the bush is on fire, the bush is not being burned up. It's not so much that the bush is on fire that the bush is in fire, or fire is in the bush. Maybe say it that way. There's fire in the bush, but the bush is not being harmed. The bush is not turning to ashes. The bush is fully alive, and yet there's fire in the bush. And so Moses turns aside. Turns aside. Whatever it is he was going to do, he lets that go. He's going to turn aside and behold this wonder. Contemplate the wonder of a bush that's on fire or in fire or fire in a bush, but the bush is not being burned up. I think this is very important. Moses gives place to wonder and encounters the divine. Moses gives attention to wonder and hears the voice of God. All that Moses will become famous for, the Exodus, the Ten Commandments, leading Israel through the wilderness, comes about as a result of this single mystical encounter with a burning bush. Of course, the point is, the burning bush is the glory of God in the bush. When we visited St. Catherine's Monastery at the foot of Mount Horeb in Mount Sinai, the site of the longest continual worship of Christians in the world. They have been praying there 5 times a day, every day, without fail, for 17 centuries. The monks there showed us a bush, and they said, "That's the bush." I said, "Okay." I was not about to argue with them. It was a very large green bush that they identify as the burning bush. Now, you may think, I wish I could see that bush, or a bush like that. I wish I could see a bush on fire with God. Well, you can. Of course you can. Don't you know? Every bush is on fire with God. Every bush, every tree, every bird, every blade of grass, every grain of sand, and even the innumerable stars are all on fire with the glory of God. But in our hurry, we're in a hurry, aren't we? We're in a hurry. I was a young man in a hurry once. In our hurry to be something, got to be something, got to become something, make something of yourself. In our hurry to be something, in our hurry to do something, we just rush past it all. Though love is smiling through all things. It's all there. It's all on fire with the glory of God. But we're just, you know, I've got things to do. We rush all the way through life and we never. It took Moses all the way into middle life, having become what the world calls a failure, for him to get slow enough. Wow. God's in that bush. And perhaps God thought, at last. Finally, some guy's paying attention. That's what I can work with. See, we think, well, if God's going to do some great thing, he's got to find a great man, a great woman, a great leader, great abilities, great success. And God says, no, I don't really need that. I need someone who can slow down, become enough of a failure in Pharaoh's system of more, 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 that they can turn aside and behold wonder and begin to recognize that indeed in every bush, every tree, every bird, every blade of grass, every grain of sand, and even the innumerable stars, the glory of God is present. But we rush past it all. We rush past it all. This is the life we cannot live. We can compete, we can run, but we can't live. So we need to find a Sinai. We need a wilderness. We need a Horeb. We need a park. We need a quiet room. You say, where? I say, I don't know where it is for you. I do know this. Seek and you will find. You say, but if you want to find the place where the bush is burning, just tell God, I want to find that place where I can turn aside, where I can slow down, where I can be quiet. And God will show you the place. I don't know what place it'll be for you. But seek and you'll find. Walking the Camino was 40 days of quiet, uncluttered living. And though I know it sounds like a cliche, it changed me. It was quiet. It was uncluttered. I mean, it was simple. I mean, just what did I do for 40 days? Got up and walked. You know, today, you know, you go to your closet. What am I going to wear today? Not on the Camino. What are you going to wear? What I didn't wear yesterday. Because I got two pants and I got two shirts. And that's the point of the Camino. It strips you down to simplicity. People that are getting ready to walk the Camino, they'll ask Perry and me, what should I take? I give them the title of a U2 album, All That You Can't Leave Behind. And you know what? Be out on the Camino for a week or two and you'll find out, I can leave more behind. You find out you really don't need it all. You don't even need that much. You really can embrace simplicity. But you're not going to learn that lesson in Egypt where the mantra is more, more, more. Or America. It's all the same thing. You're going to have to get out into the Sinai, into the wilderness, the base of Mount Horeb, the mountain of God, and find a bush that's on fire with the glory of God. Moses removed his shoes before the burning bush because there was a miracle. But the miracle wasn't in the bush. The miracle was in Moses. Again, every bush is on fire with the glory of God. The miracle wasn't in the bush. The bush was what every other bush is. The miracle was in Moses. And having turned aside, Moses finally perceived the glory that is in all things. The first lesson that Moses learned as he awakened to the glory of God was that he was standing on holy ground. We need to recognize some holy places in order to cultivate a sense of the sacred. Again, that's the Camino for us was 40 days of walking on nothing but holy ground. I don't know how to explain it, but we never left holy ground. But see, once we learn to recognize particular places as holy places, we can go on from there and learn to recognize that all of creation is sacred. See, there is a truth in which you have never taken one step in your life that wasn't on holy ground. But to jump into the middle of that awareness is probably too big a leap. And so you begin by recognizing certain places as holy. And then you keep going until you recognize one day, it's all holy, isn't it? Wendell Berry said, there are no non-sacred places. Only sacred places and desecrated places. Well, once Moses realizes he's on holy ground, he knows he has to remove his shoes. Modern people, we march through life with a heavy booted foot because we're here to make our mark. I'm large and in charge. I want people to know I've been here. And so we have a heavy booted foot as we race through life. Moses knew the wisdom of a light foot, of going softly, gently. This is related to the ancient wisdom of recognizing holy places and take off your shoes. Just let your skin come in direct contact with this place. Have some reverence. You don't need your heavy shoes here. And so as I've traveled the world, I've been in all kinds of holy places where I take off my shoes. I mean, it's part of the qualification for admission. If you won't take off your shoes, you can't come in here. And so you have to take off your shoes. There's been all kinds of holy places where I have taken off my shoes. Mosques and Buddhist temples and Hindu temples and certain Christian churches in India. There are churches in India where their practice is you take off your shoes at the door before you enter the church. First time I was ever in India, so many, many years ago. I went to my very first church service. I was preaching there at this church in Kurukshetra, India. And I participated in their custom because, you know, that's what you do. And I took off my shoes and I left them there at the entrance. And I went in and we had church and sang and prayed and worshiped and I preached. And finally, the service was over and I come out and I'm looking around for my shoes. And I thought, well, I must have misplaced them. And I looked for a good long while, and I finally realized, they're just not here. And so I told my host, the pastor, I said, I can't seem to find my shoes. He said, oh, yeah, sometimes the Hindus, they are coming and taking our shoes. And so I left that meeting in my sock feet. Went back to my hotel in my sock feet. Went to the restaurant in my sock feet. Next morning, I went up and went to a shoe store. I walked into the store in my socks. You know, the guy in there is thinking, this is a good customer. I am definitely going to make a sale here. It's a fond memory. Sacred places, remove your shoes. But the only place in America where they make me take off my shoes is TSA security. See, that's the only place that's sacred. In a secular culture of empire, not much is sacred other than to make a fetish out of security. That's our post-9/11 reality. Bob Dylan said, disillusioned words like bullets bark as human gods aim for their mark and make everything from toy guns that spark to flesh-colored Christ that glow in the dark. It's easy to see without looking too far that not much is really sacred. Of course, Dylan means by that, if we are blind to the glory that is all around us, not much is sacred. But, like Dostoevsky who said it first, Dylan understands that the glory of God can be seen in every grain of sand. So he also sings, in the fury of the moment, can see the Master's hand in every leaf that trembles, in every grain of sand. That's a life we can live. When even in the fury of the moment, because you'll never get rid of all the furies in the moments of life, there are going to be moments where it's the fury of the moment. But the life you can live is that when even in the fury of the moment, you can see the Master's hand in every leaf that trembles, and every grain of sand. But to see the Master's hand in every grain of sand, to see every bush on fire with the glory of God, to arrive at a life that we can live, we have to cultivate practices of prayer, contemplation, and healthy soul care. That's what we're going to be talking about this month. Amen. Stand with me.